Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
The United States is the world's number one jailer, home to about 5% of the world's population, but close to 25% of its prison inmates. Our sentences are longer than the global average, and yet 60% of released offenders go on to be convicted of new crimes. Could there be a better way? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Hoping to get a sense of how other societies deal with crime and punishment, my guest spent 2 years touring prisons in 9 countries, in Europe and Australia, but also in Africa, Asia, and South America. She discovered that many countries have been influenced by what the U.S. does, but also saw novel ideas and glimmers of hope in places where prison is used as a tool for rehabilitation as well as retribution. Boz Dreisinger is associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York, and founder of the Prison to College Pipeline program. Her new book is called Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. Boz, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to what you learned in your travels, tell us a little bit about how the United States came to build the world's biggest prison system.
Well, the U.S., as you said, is the world's biggest jailer, and we have a long legacy of this. Historically, we built the first modern prison system in the 19th century that coincided with the founding of our nation. So we've long been closely tied to a kind of addiction to incarceration. But we really saw mass incarceration start to happen in the 70s, and sociologists and criminologists trace this to the war on drugs and the approach to punishment in this country that became very much about locking up particular populations.
We tend to jail people because we fear them. Is that fear justified?
Well, certainly for some people, but I don't think it's justified for the bulk of the prison population. 2.3 million people, that's a lot of people to be afraid of. So I think that fear is, we have to be smart and not be ruled by fear. And that's one of the many unfortunate things about our mass incarceration problem.
Does all that punishment by incarceration keep us safer in the United States from crime than our peers in other countries?
Well, I think the recidivism rate says it all. 60-something percent is our recidivism rate, and clearly that's an indication that this is not working. I think if any corporation were run with a 60% or 65% failure rate, you'd rethink it immediately, and yet that's what we persist to do with our prison system.
And it turns out the U.S. has been a model for many other parts of the world with regard to how you should do prisons.
Yes, this was one of the things that I found quite striking in my travels, was to see, number one, the way that historically the U.S. built the modern prison system, again in the 19th century, building what are considered the first two modern prisons in Pennsylvania and New York. And what then happened was that leaders came from around the globe to see this thing and went back and imitated versions of it. And that's sort of how it started populating the globe. And one of the things that happens with criminal justice more generally is that the world copycats America, both in terms of our drug policies, so creating populations to fill prisons, in terms of some of the private prison industry, in terms of solitary confinement. So there's all these elements of incarceration that are being replicated around the globe for centuries now.
So let's talk about the places you visited. Prisons in 9 countries over the course of a couple of years. How did you build your itinerary?
So I wanted to choose countries that were representative of an issue when we think about criminal justice, when we think about prisons. I really wanted, in many ways, for the book to be a work of philosophy that rethinks the fundamentals, the things that we take for granted around the issue of justice and around incarceration specifically. So I chose countries that were representative of particular things I wanted to think about: punishment and revenge, solitary confinement, the role of the arts and this term rehabilitation, women in prison. So each country's reflected a particular theme that I wanted to explore in the book.
It was really important to you that your interactions with inmates and your tours of prisons not feel like you were exploiting the people that you dealt with. So you offered deals to the places where you wanted to conduct your interviews. Can you talk a little bit about the services that you offered to provide?
Sure. I am fundamentally an educator, a teacher, and anytime I have the opportunity to do that and engage with students, I seize it. And it is a very, I didn't want to just sort of come in and ogle human beings. There's always going to be an element of that. I don't live in prison. When I'm in prisons in America, I don't live there, and certainly in other countries. So I wanted to try to do as much as I could when possible. So generally, when I came into a country, I would connect either with an NGO or an organization doing some connected to the prison system and asked to be involved in what they were doing and find a place where I could, on some level, fit in. So usually that meant teaching. I had the opportunity to teach creative writing and autobiography workshops, sometimes for longer spans than others. And I had the opportunity to be a workshop facilitator and in a restorative justice program. So generally my goal was to do instead of to just watch and stand aside with a pen and paper. That wasn't always possible. There are some countries where there's a lot more restrictions on outsiders coming in than others, Singapore, for instance. But whenever possible, I'm not a fan of interviews. I like conversations and I like discourse and I like the process of education. So I tried to not do interviews whenever possible.
It's really easy for those of us who've had not had a lot of direct experience with the criminal justice system to think of prison inmates, you know, as somehow distinctly different from those of us who have not been convicted of crimes. You met a lot of people that I think readers will relate to and who were surprisingly thoughtful about their lives and about their mistakes.
Yes. And in fact, I don't even use that word inmates because I think what it does is allow us to think of these people as a different class. And, you know, a different breed of human being. It's a way to dehumanize. And what I met all over the world are versions of what I have met behind bars in America, which are, for the most part, people who have been conditioned by societies that are rife with crime and inequality to live behind bars. And often this is strategic in order to create a labor force. This is certainly what happened in the U.S. But these are people who are dealing with poverty and inequality and usually structural racism as well. That's often what lands them in prison. Now, certainly there's elements of bad choices and that are in that mix as well. But for the most part, they are just like you and me, except their circumstances produce them and in many ways condition them for crime.
What did you learn traveling around about the attitude societies have with regard to criminal behavior and whether it's a fixed thing or, you know, in other words, that by definition, committing a crime makes one a criminal, or the perception that, you know, crimes are to be taken as individual actions or mistakes?
Well, and that's a great question because people ask me about murderers, you know, and I always say, or do you have murderers in your classroom, or how do we deal with murderers? And I say that there's a vast difference between a murderer and someone who has committed murder. Murderers are habitually going around murdering people, and they exist in the world, but they exist in very, very small numbers. There aren't that many Charles Mansons out there and such. And the same is true, I think, about criminals and people who have committed crimes. And unfortunately, what I find in America, what I found globally, is that there is this perception that these are criminals, that this is a brand of human being, and we have to create this system to thrust them into. And there isn't enough recognition of, no, these are actually people who have committed criminal acts or people who may have committed a vile deed such as murder. I think the push, really, and one of the impetuses for writing the book was to make people understand this and make people see this. There is a humanity behind bars that needs to be addressed, and we need to think of them as people first who have committed these acts.
On the other hand, Boz, as I know that you are aware, surely there are people listening who will ask, why should we care at all about conditions for those who have broken the law? Didn't they sort of forfeit their right to being treated with a certain amount of compassion when they hurt another person?
Well, for one, we have to recognize that it's the conditions in our society that often produced these acts, that we're implicated in the harmful acts that people commit when we tolerate conditions in our society that are so unequal, that are, again, you know, thinking about this idea of conditioning people for crime. Of course, people have free will, but certainly I think some people have more free will than others because they've been given more opportunity than others. So for one, it's about recognizing our own, the way that we as a society society are implicated in people's acts when they come from ghettos or townships in South Africa or favelas in Brazil. These are, you know, structurally unequal societies. And then the other thing we need to recognize is that people in prison, the bulk of them are going to come home. We are in this together. They're coming home to our communities, to our worlds. And so instead of fostering this us versus them approach, what we need to do is think about, okay, we're all in this society together. We're in a community together. So how can we make this work? And so therefore, it's not an us and them thing. They are us.
Speaking of us and them, or not us and them, the first place you went was Rwanda, or at least the first place you write about is Rwanda in the book. And NGOs there facilitate visits to prisons by genocide survivors. What is the purpose of programs like these?
Well, that was a program that I actually helped start in Rwanda with an organization called Never Again Rwanda. And I did start my journey in Rwanda, and I wanted to do that because of the fact that I wanted to pay attention to victims first. And that's it's a restorative justice approach. But ultimately, it's not about how can we punish offenders, but how do we deal with the needs of victims? And so I chose Rwanda because obviously after the genocide, you had this massive number of victims who were dealing with traumas and for whom justice had to be found. And I was very interested in the way that Rwanda did this in a non-traditional way. And so I came out there, it was about 20 years after the genocide and after the process of dealing with that, and I worked with young genocide survivors who were interested in visiting prisons as a show of peace, as a show of reconciliation, and as a way of healing. They were young enough such that they may not remember the genocide, but almost all of them were orphaned by it. So it's a tremendous scar in their life. And they found incredible healing by setting up this program. I worked with them to kind of coordinate it, get government permission for them to go inside the prisons. And what I encountered in Rwanda, both thinking about the history of genocide and also in these visits with these young people, was the power of an approach to justice that's grounded in forgiveness and restitution and reparations instead of punishment and harm. I mean, they walked out of the prison in Rwanda that first visit, which I accompanied them on, and they were elated to have encountered these people in the prisons, and they found enormous healing in it.
Your own family includes victims and survivors of the Holocaust. You write that that history hung like a sinister cloud of mental illness. That's a quote over your family.
Yes, yes. I mean, I feel that I grew up in a house deeply impacted by the Holocaust, and I also grew up with a lot of bitterness and pain surrounding that. And of course, that's certainly understandable. This is trauma, and no one can be blamed for how you deal with trauma. But I do think that there, what I saw in Rwanda was another way. And it was a focus not on the bitterness of being harmed, but rather how do I repair this harm? How do I make amends for it? And I was deeply inspired by that.
To be clear, you went to Rwanda feeling skeptical about the truth that this national pursuit of forgiveness could actually work. What convinced you that it did mean something and it was real?
Well, and I think it's always hard to tell. I always recognize I'm an outsider, and my perspective is that of an outsider. What I saw, for one, with these young people, with the young genocide survivors, what I witnessed in them and in engaging with them and talking about forgiveness was that, number one, such a thing is possible. And what I learned about, I mean, I had heard about the Gacaca courts in Rwanda, which are these community courts whereby people got to air their harms and make restitution. I saw that this could happen, and the dialogue that I had with people around forgiveness really convinced me that my theory could be brought into practice.
Boz Dreisinger is my guest. We're talking about her new book, Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Boz Dreisinger, associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York, and founder of the Prison to College Pipeline Program. Her new book is called Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Buzz, another place you went was South Africa, and this is a country that there's no varnishing the truth. They have a real problem with homicide in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I'm sorry. Please continue.
No, I was going to say they also have a long legacy of structural inequality and racism that produced that high homicide rate.
Yeah, you found that it wasn't only in the United States where race has a great deal to do with who is incarcerated for crimes and who receives some other form of punishment, if any.
I saw a very troubling pattern of kind of defining a group as an other, whether that's through race or poverty or both, or sometimes ethnic groups as in Thailand, and then incarcerating them en masse. And again, usually it's to produce a labor force because many prisons became a labor force post-slavery around the world. And this is certainly true in South Africa. It was true in Brazil. It's true in Australia when we talk about the Aboriginal populations. It's incredibly depressing.
So you went to this place called the Polesmore Correctional Facility, and the sign out front says a place of new beginnings. Did you find that to be so?
Well, yes, it's new beginnings, but they're not exactly positive ones. Mm. Polesmore is it's considered the largest prison in Africa. There are almost 10,000 men, women, and children locked up there. Many of them have not even been to trial yet, so they're not even technically convicted of anything. And it's one of the most notorious prisons in the world for its violence. There are gangs that essentially control it and run it. There's a frighteningly high tuberculosis rate, so people are getting sick. It's understaffed. There are barely any social workers. And it's really kind of like a free-for-all in terms of the violence and disease.
And are there ways that people are trying to make things better? Is there a possibility to go through a system like that and come out a better person?
Well, I worked with one person who is trying to do that and laboring away, devoted his life to it. He's a pastor in Cape Town, South Africa, who himself spent time in Polesmore Prison, came out and wanted to do something positive. And so he runs a restorative justice workshop all over the country, but really grounded in Polesmore, where he works with the incarcerated folks there to think about their choices, their actions, and how to change their lives, and also especially how to make amends with the people that they've harmed, which is the essence of what restorative justice is about. It's about restoration and reparations instead of revenge and punishment and harm. So he runs these very intensive workshops, which I had the honor of being a part of. I served as a facilitator in one of these workshops.
And at the heart of that is this question that you wrestled with as well. How do you know when someone is truly sorry, and how do you know when someone is simply saying what they think they're expected to say?
Yeah, and the answer to that question is you don't. Mm. You never fully know. You have to assess it. But I tend to think in terms of actions over words. So, I mean, you know someone is sorry when they don't do it again. And I think this is a really important issue because restorative justice is not only about saying I'm sorry or, you know, forgive me, apology. It's about what actions can you take in order to repair the harm. So I think whenever we think about apology, when we think about forgiveness, we also have to think about restitution and reparations, which is an action word.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks to your guests for today. You touched on it just a moment ago, my question. So I was asking if in your research across the world, if you had seen any just trends related to faith-based programs in the jails, in the prisons. And if so, it sounds like you've had some firsthand experience there. It doesn't seem to get as much media attention. I'm wondering if you could speak to why that might be, and how someone could get involved, actually.
Yeah, very interesting question. I think that actually some of the most progressive work that's being done in prisons, both in the U.S. and internationally, is faith-based. And I mean, I come at this from a secular perspective, but it's very interesting. In South Africa, this is the case. There's an organization called Prison Fellowship, which is a Christian organization based in the U.S., but they have international offices all over the globe. In fact, they're probably the most far-reaching organization. So I would start with Prison Fellowship in terms of being involved. But I think that the ethos of forgiveness and apology is deeply embedded in many of the Christian beliefs. So it sort of makes for a natural fit with these organizations.
In order to be fully effective, do those organizations sort of count on people converting or already being a member of the faiths that are administering them?
So they don't, as in Polsmore, no, they don't profess that that's the case. I have found that there is kind of an undercurrent of conversion there, and there's certainly a presence of religious talk in a lot of the work. But that's not always the case. And I think almost all of them would say, we're interested in souls and humanity, and whatever your faith is doesn't matter. It's just a question of how that gets played out. It certainly did in Polsmore. I think I'm a great fan of the work that the pastor is doing in South Africa, but there was definitely a religious element to his work.
So there are people who are really intrigued by the idea of, you know, putting the arts and arts programs into prisons. There are other people who absolutely bristle at the idea that these things that are considered, you know, amenities or luxuries by some people are there. What did you learn? What have you learned about the value of artistic expression for people who are behind bars?
It's enormously valuable. Again, we're talking about we're supposed to be correcting people, right? We talk about a Department of Corrections. So theoretically, we're not supposed to be punishing. We're supposed to be correcting. And surely the arts are incredibly therapeutic, healing, capable of producing bursts of self-awareness, consciousness about the world and the self. And so I worked in Uganda and Jamaica in arts programs. In Uganda, I had the chance to found a creative writing workshop at Luzira Prison in Kampala. And in Jamaica, I briefly visited a reggae program, a music program in a prison in Kingston. And these are both tremendously powerful programs. There are organizations in the U.S. that do similar work around drama, theater, writing, and music programs. And it's all incredibly powerful. Can it solve the problem? Of course not. I mean, I call it a Band-Aid on an amputated limb, because when you have a really broken system, as you do in Uganda and Jamaica particularly, these are some of the worst, most overcrowded, least rehabilitative prisons that I've ever been in. So having a little music program or a little writing program is not going to solve that. But it is definitely part of the healing process that we should all want to see in our prisons. I mean, we want people to come home better than they were. We want to produce better citizens. We want to support opportunities. And so the arts is very powerful in that.
What have you learned about how to get students sort of to check at the door the hard shells that they have to form to survive in prison? Because in order to really engage with the arts, you have to be a little bit vulnerable. This is not something that is typically wise in a prison, particularly in a prison as dangerous as those in Jamaica and Uganda.
Yeah, it's kind of a paradox about doing that work. And I find this even just teaching writing, as I do in New York inside a prison. You have to create this classroom as a hub, as a little safe space where the kind of defensiveness that you have to cultivate in order to survive goes away. And the classroom can really become that. But the unfortunate part is that the rest of the prison environment breaks that down once they leave the classroom. If you can do it on a sustained level, which I work to do in New York in the Prison to College Pipeline, then you can really change lives. And so they take that sense of there is someone I can trust and there is a place that I can let my guard down. They'll take that around the prison with them. And I like to think kind of promote it in other spaces. But around the world, that was an incredibly difficult thing to do. I came and went in Uganda and Jamaica both. So it's not as if it can be sustained. But it's the paradox, I think, of trying to bring humanity to spaces where there is no humanity, where it's all about sucking the humanity out. And that's what the modern prison system is really all about.
Occasionally doing this show, I will receive a letter from someone who is incarcerated somewhere in Texas that hears the show. And I have never failed to be impressed by how well these individuals tend to write and how much time they put into their work. I'm wondering how you conceived the prison to college pipeline and if you'd had similar experiences with being really impressed by the ability that some individuals have to educate themselves if given any opportunity behind bars.
Yeah, well, that being impressed is actually why I started the program. It was through educational volunteering, I would go into prisons and I would see the level of intelligence and intellect and possibility and lack of opportunity. And I thought, why are we allowing all of this greatness to languish away behind bars when it could be contributing to our society in such profound ways? So it didn't surprise me, I think, when I encountered that, but it moved me deeply. And so really, I see the Prison College Pipeline program, which is, in a nutshell, it's a college program behind bars that also then funnels the folks coming home from prison into the university system as kind of their new beginning and their new start. And it's really about allowing people the opportunities that they should have had in the first place to enact all of this intelligence and allowing them the educational opportunities that they didn't have to develop their skills and be able to be the brilliant citizens that they are.
Let's go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Bruce on the line in Arlington. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I've been thought a lot about this whole issue of mass incarceration, and I know there are some really easy solutions, like, you know, ending for-profit prisons, bolstering the public defender system, changing from retribution to rehabilitation. But I was wondering, how do you change public's perceptions about that? Because I think a lot of times the public still sees it as a good versus bad thing, steeped in their own views and morality, where they see only bad people are going to jail. And they don't understand that until someone close to them or themselves are affected, that the system is not really geared toward deciding who's right, who's bad and good. It's more about just picking up people and sending them off. How do you change the public's perceptions on that? How do you change them? Because I think once you change their perceptions, the politicians will be more likely to change the laws.
What do you think, Buzz?
Absolutely. That's such a great question. And I'm also glad that you brought up all of the other things that need to be fixed, because you can't fix a prison system without fixing everything. It's all a holistic, you know, it's a grand social thing. That's a big part of why I wrote this book, for one. The book is full of narratives, it's stories, it's full of human beings, and we need to see these human beings. And part of the problem with our system is that we don't. We keep prisons hidden away. They're kind of the dark corners of the world. So most people are not seeing what happens. So for one, we need greater transparency, and there needs to be more of an opportunity for people to see their own justice system at work. And I actually also in the book think about this idea of a kind of marketing campaign around exposing people to who is in prison. Via whether it's billboards or subway ads or TV ads, how do we allow people to experience the prison population in a human way? And again, not just think of them as convicts and inmates. So I think that changing public perception is huge. Again, why that's such an important question, because public perception is what pushes for policy all over the world. And I found this globally. So in order to change, you know, it's if the public is demanding tough on crime, that's what the politicians will give them. But if the public is demanding smart on crime and something else and a humanity-based system, then that's what the politicians do. They cater to the public. So I am all about, and I actually, in Singapore, I had the experience of witnessing this kind of a public campaign. They have something called the Yellow Ribbon Project, where they actually it's all about changing public perceptions of people coming home from prison and encouraging the hiring of formerly incarcerated people and encouraging acceptance of this population when they come home.
That's something that is very difficult in this country because, of course, you're required to tell a prospective employer if you have felony convictions on your record. And when you're in competition with somebody else and you've got a felony conviction, you know, 99 times out of 100, you're not going to get the job.
Yes. And in fact, there are studies that show that overt discrimination in that regard is higher than discrimination in any other sort of category, gender, race. That's how deep it runs. There's a movement now. I mean, there's a number of movements, but there's a particularly powerful one around what's called ban the box to end that so that we can actually hire people based on skills and abilities and not this kind of blanket discrimination.
You focused on solitary confinement when you visited Brazil. What kinds of violations put inmates at risk of solitary?
Well, all kinds, unfortunately. And this is, again, this is something that's true in the U.S. and it's true globally. It can be something small and random, looking at an officer the wrong way. The prison that I went to in Brazil is a supermax that's modeled after the American model of supermaxes, where people are in solitary confinement for 22 hours a day. And it was an absolutely chilling, terrifying place to visit. And I actually did conduct interviews there through the slats of a solitary confinement cell. I witnessed a level of trauma that was simply appalling. But I think the most appalling thing might be the fact that the men that were in there, some of them were in there for really no good reason. And it was increasingly unclear to me what the rationale was for having them there. They were being called the worst of the worst. But when I would inquire about someone's, you know, particular, the nature of their quote unquote worst of the worst, I heard things like, oh, he spit in a prosecutor's face. And that's not a reason to lock someone up in solitary confinement for years and years at a time while their brain atrophies. And then eventually we return them in that condition. So solitary confinement is easily one of the most glaring horror shows when it comes to the prison system. And again, it's one of those things that it's a model that America developed, this idea of the supermax prison and this idea of solitary, and then sort of foisted upon the world in various ways.
Boz Dreisinger is my guest. She's founder of the Prison to College Pipeline Program and author of a new book called Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Boz Dreisinger, associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York, and founder of the Prison to College Pipeline Program. Her new book is called Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Boz, I just want to go back to what you were saying earlier about the long-term effects of solitary confinement. Again, if one has not experienced this, you might assume that the punishment is excruciating at the time, but then you get back, into group confinement or you are released and it's all good. But in fact, there is evidence to show that the brain effects may be irreversible.
Absolutely. And I mean, in many ways, I see solitary as just an extreme version of the harm and trauma we inflict on anyone in prison, whether in solitary or not. But there have been extensive studies done on solitary, and it can destroy you for life psychologically.
You went to Thailand to look at how women were treated in prison. The women are the fastest growing segment of the prison population globally. Is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I worked with the I went to Thailand because they have a very large number of women who are incarcerated there. And I worked with the Princess of Thailand. She's very invested in this issue. And so she founded an NGO called Inspire to create these kind of model prisons for women around the country. She's also very invested in legislation around women and incarceration. But ultimately, she's so committed to this because many of these women are in for, almost all of them are in for drug-related crimes. There are very draconian punishments for drug crimes in Thailand, and it particularly impacts women because, for the most part, they have co-defendants, and they're usually their husbands or boyfriends. And so they're sort of hapless foot soldiers in a drug trade, and thus hapless victims of a drug trade. Given gender roles in the context of Thailand, too, it's especially difficult if your boyfriend or husband says, carry this package from here to there, to not do it. So women are being victimized by the criminal justice system. And the princess has set up these really interesting spaces for them that are almost like retreats, certainly prisons, and not, you know, not in any way cushy. But there's a lot of rehabilitative programming going on there. There's yoga. There's therapy. There's computer workshops and massage training. I went with a colleague from John Jay and led a drama workshop there. So some really interesting things happening. And she's also committed to global change around the particular needs of women. Incarcerated women have needs that are different from men, and also are not reflected in the way that we run prisons today.
Are most women in Thai prisons, do they have access to these kinds of services?
Absolutely not. This is not, and I'm very clear about this in the book, this is not representative of the prisons in Thailand at all, but it's really more, it's kind of a statement about what could be instead of a statement about what is. And the women that are in there are absolutely representative of the kinds of women that are filling the prisons in Thailand.
Many Americans have begun to be uneasy about the rise of private for-profit prison companies. You had some misgivings in advance to your trip to such a facility in Australia. What did you find?
So I have many, many misgivings. I think everyone who is at all even remotely progressive around prisons is disgusted by the power of private prison companies, the for-profit prison industry. And that's because, quite simply, they're making money off people's backs and they have tremendous control over legislation. They need to keep beds filled, and so they lobby for draconian punishments and long sentences. And this is all horrific and very, very shameful, these billion-dollar companies that are controlling our justice system. And I went to Australia to think about this because Australia has the largest number of people in private prisons in the world. And the model is fundamentally bereft. But what I saw happening in the particular private prisons that I went to in Western Australia was pretty incredible. One of them was a facility for young men between 18 and 24, and it was an open prison. The young men were permitted to go and come and engage in community service and restorative justice work. That place really did kind of look like a retreat. And then I went to a more traditional prison that was a private prison that actually quite resembled the prison that I work in New York. So it's very traditional in that sense. But the director of education there was doing all kinds of innovative work in order to turn this place into actually a place of corrections. So what I found was that In these, and again, these are not representative. There's many horror shows reflected in the Australian private prison industry, and many scandals have happened over the years. But what I saw with these two was that there was a space for innovation that maybe dealing with the state bureaucracy would complicate. So it was something that I struggled with. I mean, Wandu, which was the facility for the young men, I thought, wow, I have so many students who would have been eligible for a place like this in America if we have it, but we don't. And so my experience of actually being inspired by a particular private prison was very unsettling. But it definitely does not change my absolute loathing for the private prison industry and the way that it's run socially here and most of the time globally.
That separate sort of mini system for young offenders is interesting to me because it occurred to me that it really kind of parallels the ages at which American young men of privilege would be in college and are kind of allowed to make some mistakes.
Yes, of course. I mean, and this is certainly true in Australia. Actually, Australia, the part of Western Australia where I was, had the highest young Aboriginal incarceration rate in the country, and their rates as far as locking up Aboriginal peoples is even higher than African Americans in the U.S. So they're it's definitely particularly targeting people, and particularly targeting young people who then are damaged at a very vulnerable age.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Tim on the line in Qu'Appelle. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a fascinating show. I was curious about a reference that the speaker made earlier to incarceration as a means to create a labor force. And that would suggest that there's someone with a motive, that it's not just accidental. And I'm wondering if that's really what you're saying, and if so, is there evidence of that? Do you have evidence of someone with a motive to create a labor force, and who that is? And I'll take my answer off the line. Thanks.
Great question. So I was talking about the history of how prisons got built. There isn't a one person. There never is. It's about a structure or a system. But the way that prisons, and this is certainly true, we know that in America we had the Black Codes post-slavery that basically criminalized a whole host of activities that are associated with freed slaves. So loitering became a crime that could land you in prison. And why did we do this? Because we lost a labor force after slavery. And prison labor into the 20th century became that labor force. So you're talking about a structure that intentionally criminalized an entire population. And what I found are versions of this around the globe. This happened post-slavery in Brazil, where the prison labor became a replacement post-slavery, and Brazil had slavery well into the 20th century. And other versions of the same was true. All of these prisons around the world historically were created as labor force and were involved in using prison labor that became very critical to these countries' economies. And this persists. And we still have, Whole Foods recently got into a scandal around using prison labor for its fish, I believe, in from some of the private prisons. There are all kinds of industries that still rely on prison labor, whether it's the DMV in your city, whether it's, again, Whole Foods or these progressive places we wouldn't even expect. So there's a tie between prison and capitalism that runs very, very deep. And it's not just the private prison industry either. State prisons, phone companies are making these prison phone companies are charging inordinate rates and making lots of money off of this. We always have to see the relationship between prisons and capitalism. In fact, the modern prison was born alongside capitalism, was sort of modeled after a factory. The modern prison, the idea of the modern prison came about in the late 18th century alongside capitalism, and it was a way of kind of producing a factory for human beings.
Prison in Norway is radically different than what we know in the U.S. or what exists in most other parts of the world. Can you tell us how it's structured?
So Norway's getting a lot of attention these days because of its progressive approaches to criminal justice. And there's a model throughout Scandinavia, and Norway in many ways has perfected it, of what's called an open prison. And so these are prisons where people can, the people incarcerated there can come and go sometimes for the weekend to visit family, work jobs out of the prison and come back at night, and are very much incorporated into their communities. And it's kind of, in Norway, they think of it as a principle of normality, trying to connect people, keep people connected to their communities even while they're serving time. And so I visited the most famous of these in Norway. It's called Bastøy. It's on an island. It's a nature preserve. It's a pretty incredible place. And what I saw there was, and this is what the governor, he's not called a warden, he's called a governor of the prison, kept saying, if you treat people like dirt, they will be dirt. But if you treat them like human beings, they'll be human beings. And it sounds simplistic, but I actually saw that enacted. I went to two prisons in Norway, Bastoy, and also another one called Halden, which does have a wall and is a more traditional one. But the conditions are incredible. The programming in terms of what the incarcerated men there can do is mind-blowing. So what you're seeing is a system that really is trying to be about rehabilitation, that is trying to be about corrections. And there's also a greater acceptance of people coming home from prison. Again, there's this conception that it's not us and them, but we're part of a community together.
But there is pressure even within Norway to make those prisons tougher places to get buy-in.
Unfortunately, there's a rising kind of xenophobic strain in Norway, yes. That's pushing for stricter punishments and harsher punishments. And there's also a strain that says we need to imitate America and America's tough on crime approach. But as an eternal optimist, I like to think that those forces won't win in the end.
Do you think the United States is capable of remaking its prison system so that inmates stop offending and victims feel that they've achieved justice? What would have to happen different?
Absolutely. I think I couldn't do this work if I didn't think it was possible. Is it going to take an enormous lift and a lot of work and a lot of minds? Yes. I think one of the things that has to happen, it sort of has to happen on three levels, the before, the during, and the after. So for one, the before means we need to create societies that don't manufacture crime and instead manufacture opportunities and possibilities and safety. So and that's actually what's being called justice reinvestment. So it's investing in communities to prevent crime in the first place. So you don't have people. We're not funneling people from certain communities directly into the prison system and sort of using the prison system as our welfare system, which is as it exists. And then I think there's the during, where we need to really look at conditions of confinement and what we're doing with people if and when we do send them to prison. And then after that, we need to think about, okay, if someone is sent to prison, how can we create a society that well integrates them upon release and not just throw this term reentry around like a buzzword, but actually create opportunities for people coming home to prison from prison to enact their full possibilities. I mean, I think I am not a believer in prison as a way of dealing, of creating justice altogether. My passion is for restorative justice approaches. And again, not thinking in terms of harm and punishment, but reparations and restitution. So certainly my big picture vision of justice involves restorative justice at the heart of it. And finding ways to create sort of what I saw in Rwanda and what I saw in South Africa around systems of reparation as opposed to systems of punishment and harm.
Why do you think our system as it is continues when there is a, as you describe it, a 60% failure rate, 60% recidivism rate for people who've been released?
Well, I think some of it, and this has been talked about quite a bit, of course, the Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, lays it out. Some of this is part of an insidious plot to oppress certain communities of color, that historically this has been the case. And so there's motive there. And I talked about the profit motive as well, that so much of our economy revolves around this. But I also think some of it is just a kind of laziness and a sort of, well, we've done this for so long, so we might as well just keep on doing this. And that's what I find so distressing, because we often think of prisons as, it's always been this way. But in fact, it's a relatively recent invention that's only about 200 years old. It can be changed.
Boz Dreisinger's new book is called Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. Boz, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.